KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A California woman and her brother prepared to evacuate, but decided first to hose down the fire in their backyard. We have glimpses of the LA wildfires in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. We speak with the councilwoman who represents one of the neighborhoods that's been engulfed in flames, Pacific Palisades. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The fire reached the Getty Villa Museum, but not its collection. We'll hear from the Getty Trust's leader. Also, we placed a call to Plains, Georgia, and we have a conversation with Kim Carter Fuller, niece of former President Jimmy Carter, whose funeral is today. It's Thursday, January 9th. 7 years ago today, mudslides struck California hillsides that had been stripped of vegetation by wildfire. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The three major wildfires burning in Southern California remain out of control. The Eaton, the Palisades, and the Hearst fires have destroyed about 2,000 buildings and killed five people. Some 130,000 people have been ordered to evacuate. The wildfires have been so overwhelming, L.A. fire authorities don't have enough crews to cope. West of Los Angeles, the fire hydrants went dry early yesterday morning as fire crews battled the Palisades fire. Mark McMillan was in one neighborhood and says there were only two fire trucks available.
They also don't have water in their trucks, and so they have been setting up pumps that go from the pools in the neighbors on either side of this house. And they've just been trying to keep it down. The fire is too big for two engines to be able to stop.
The National Weather Service warns that powerful winds that have fueled the wildfires are calmer this morning, but they could gain strength again today. President Carter's state funeral continues today. A memorial service will be held at Washington National Cathedral. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, all the living U.S. presidents are expected to attend.
All the presidents will be there, but President Biden, who has known Carter since the 1970s, is the only one with a speaking role. The White House says he will remember Carter as a man of great character, decent and honorable, courageous and compassionate, humble and strong. Thanks to Carter's incredible longevity, two other eulogies will be read by the sons of the men who wrote them. Both former President Gerald Ford and former Vice President Walter Mondale wrote eulogies for Carter, but Carter outlived them both. Country stars Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood are set to sing Carter's favorite song, Imagine, by John Lennon. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
President-elect Trump met with Senate Republicans yesterday behind closed doors. They discussed his top legislative priorities. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports there's still disagreement among GOP lawmakers in the House and the Senate on the best way forward.
Trump has previously said he wanted one bill on big components of his agenda, border security and tax cuts. That's in line with what House Speaker Mike Johnson wants. But there's interest on the Senate side in a two-bill strategy. Trump left the meeting and said he doesn't have a strong preference.
We had a great meeting. There's great unity. Whether it's one bill or two bills, it's going to get done one way or the other. I think there's a lot of talk about two, and there's a lot of talk about one, but it doesn't matter. The end result is the same.
This doesn't provide the clear marching orders that many in the party were hoping for. Once Trump is inaugurated on the 20th, Republicans will have unified government, and how they act on priority legislation out of the gate may set the tone for their agenda going forward. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, The Capitol.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Lebanon's parliament has chosen a new president for the country. It's Lebanese Army Commander Joseph Aoun. Lebanon has been without a president for more than 2 years because of political deadlock. The country is also facing several crises. These include Israel's attack on the militant group Hezbollah based in Lebanon and the country's dire economic situation. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai has released a report about counterfeiting and online pharmacies. Tai says that nearly all 35,000 online pharmacies around the world are being run illegally. She says many are operating without a license and selling medicines without prescriptions or safety warnings. This week's Billboard charts are out, and the usual holiday hits have been cleared away. NPR's Stephen Thompson reports they've made room for a new number one song.
Last week, the top 16 songs in the country were all about, well, Christmas. This week, every one of those songs has dropped off the charts, freeing up spots for most of the tracks that were popular last fall. But it's not an exact return to the pre-holiday status quo. In fact, the country's new number one song is hitting the top of the charts for the very first time. It's Die With a Smile, a duet by Lady Gaga and Bruno Mars. The song followed a long road to number one. Even though it debuted in the top 10 last August, it didn't hit the top spot until its 20th week on the chart. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, President-elect Trump is pressing Republican senators to pass his policy priorities and says he doesn't much mind just how.
First, though, we have an update on the fires burning through the Los Angeles area. Today, every school in Los Angeles is closed. It's one way that wildfires have affected the nation's second largest city.
The fires have sometimes destroyed whole neighborhoods. They wrecked the homes of celebrities. Billy Crystal says he lost the house where he's lived with his wife since 1979. Several people are dead that we know of so far, and new fires appear as desert winds blow embers around the region.
We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could you just give us an overview of the kind of destruction that these fires are causing?
Well, a lot of the destruction so far is from the Pacific Palisades fire, which is where one of the two biggest fires is burning. News choppers were able to fly over that affluent coastal community yesterday and filmed block after block of homes reduced to ash. Homes in nearby Malibu also burned. The Hollywood Hills caught fire last night, and that blaze has quickly spread, forcing chaotic evacuations there. I was able yesterday to get into a neighborhood ravaged by the other big fire, the Eaton Fire, in Altadena on the east side of Los Angeles. I walked past more than 20 homes burning or already burned to the ground, and that was over just a couple of blocks.
I mean, it just sounds like a horrific scene there. Would you just describe more about what you saw?
You know, well, the ruins of many of the houses in the neighborhood where I was were still burning, and every so often something under the rubble would explode or a wooden door frame would finish collapsing, and it would shoot up this puff of embers. And it was windy, so neighbors were rushing to make sure that those embers didn't set their houses on fire. I met Brittany Mann as she and her brother were hosing down their roof and their lawns before evacuating.
The street behind us are what caught fire, so our backyard caught fire. So we're still trying to get those fires out before we leave.
And across the street, Michelle, I met Sarah Rudd. She evacuated on Tuesday night, but while she was gone, her neighbor, who had not evacuated, noticed that her house had caught fire, and she said that he grabbed his hose.
Some of our neighbors who stayed back when they shouldn't have, they actually saved
a lot of homes. Like our house right here, you can see where it's charred on the side, and he saved our house.
When we spoke, she had just come back to check on her house. She was leaving it again. But as we spoke, other houses were burning on her block. So hers was still at risk, and there were no firefighters around.
Adrian, to that point, we've been hearing about how there just don't seem to be enough resources to fight all these fires. What can you tell us about that?
Well, fire officials have said LA just doesn't have enough firefighters to tackle so many large fires at once. The ones who have been out there since Tuesday are exhausted. LA's mayor, Karen Bass, says that more crews are coming in from other counties and cities. Officials also said that some of the fire hydrants that firefighters were tapping into in the Pacific Palisades went dry on Tuesday. Winds that day had prevented aircraft from doing water drops, so hydrants were the only option, and they couldn't take the strain. Janice Quinones is LA's top water official.
You're fighting a wildfire with a fire hydrant system. Fire hydrants are not made to fight multiple houses, hundreds of houses at a time.
She said that officials are still working to fill the tanks and the reservoirs where water is needed.
Adrian, do you have any sense of when these fires may be under control?
No, not really, Michelle. There are several major fires burning across the region. Conditions are extremely dry, and it's the winds spreading these flames and making this also unpredictable. High winds are expected at least through tonight, so this emergency is not over.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Adrian, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
The Palisades fire has spread to the grounds of the Getty Villa. The museum holds more than 44,000 antiquities from ancient Greece and Rome. Trees and vegetation on the property have burned, but the museum's structures and its collection are safe and intact. That's according to our next guest, Catherine Fleming. She is the president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust, which operates the museum. Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Fleming.
Good morning. Good morning, Michelle.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about what is happening around the villa this morning?
Well, what is happening around the villa is still an active fire zone. As you've just heard, there are very strong and unpredictable winds, largely offshore winds today, that are making this an ongoing crisis. The Palisades fire, within which the Getty Villa is found, has grown over the course of the night, moved further north and further east. But at the Getty Villa itself, all of the stuff on the ground that was going to burn has burned. And thankfully, because we had been planning for an event of this sort, but certainly not of these proportions, we'd been planning for a long time, a lot of the brush had already been cleared out over the course of the past year before the fire arrived. So at the villa itself, we have staff, we have great staff on site keeping an eye out, but things have largely calmed down for us there.
Well, that's good to hear. Can you just say more about how, what kind of planning went into this and protecting the museum structures and the items in the collection? And I also, of course, do want to know how you're keeping the staff safe.
The staff obviously are the number one priority. The Getty, for anyone who knows it, has a super strong culture of safety. It's really safety obsessed, and also is acutely aware of the fact that it's a repository for a global cultural heritage that we hold sort of on behalf of the world. So we are constantly, in all sorts of ways, not just in terms of fires, running all kinds of exercises to make sure that we have systems in place to protect people and to protect the collection. In the case of fires, what we have done is just constant and really extensive brush clearance around all of our buildings, done all sorts of improvements. We do what's called fuel reduction. So you prune and you thin the trees. You do everything you can to lift, raise the tree canopies up from the ground. None of it's sexy, but it's all super important at a moment like this. You thin out low-level plant materials to reduce the mass. And that really helps to reduce the fire load and, takes a lot of the velocity out of the fire as it comes through. Go ahead.
I was going to say that, the Getty Center in Brentwood temporarily closed in 2017 and 2019 due to fires burning nearby. Did you learn some lessons from that?
Well, absolutely. I think all of us together are learning that urban centers are not immune from this, especially in a geography like Los Angeles's, where the urban center includes forest, it includes open land, and it includes very, very dry mountainsides. So yes, absolutely. next time you're up at the center, mm-hmm. you can look around and you'll see there are no plants anywhere really near the buildings. That's precisely because of this.
It's like the very things that make it such a gorgeous area to live in are the very things that make it so dangerous right now. Do you have any evacuation plans in place for any particular items?
No, we would not be evacuating items. We have designed our sites to make sure that items would probably the safest place for the items to be in an event like this, wild as it sounds, is to be at one of our sites. It would be a pretty bad move to try and evacuate anything during an event of this sort. You know, up at the villa itself, the buildings are of super high rated fire resistive construction. We've got double walled structures. There's really, really significant protection for the galleries kind of hardwired into the design of the buildings.
So that's good to hear. Before we let you go, do you mind if I ask, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm way, way more okay than lots and lots of people in this city are. I have a home, thank God. And where I am at the base of the hill of the Getty Center, it smells like smoke, but I can breathe pretty easily. So really, our number one concern right now is for all of the people who aren't doing anywhere near as well as I am. But thank you for asking.
That is Catherine Fleming. She's president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust. Thank you so much for talking to us. And we're going to keep a good thought for you and for everybody else who's affected by this and of course, for the collection.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
The stock markets are closed today, joining a national day of mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen reports on a tradition that goes back almost 160 years.
The New York Stock Exchange usually begins the day like this. But today, as the nation officially mourns former President Jimmy Carter, Wall Street will be listening to another kind of bell. Those bells are from the funeral of former President George H.W. Bush in 2018. That's the last time the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ closed to honor a U.S. president. They're closing again today to mourn Carter. Tal Cohen is NASDAQ's president.
Collectively, we want to make the decision to honor former President Carter for his service during the time he was president, but again, more than that, all that he contributed to our country and, quite frankly, the globe after his presidency.
This tradition began in 1865 when President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. The New York Stock Exchange shut for days. Since then, Wall Street has closed its doors several times.
We also did it for President Roosevelt, President Kennedy, President Nixon, President Reagan.
It's pretty rare for the stock market to close in the middle of the week. But it's also happened after national disasters, including the September 11th terrorist attacks and Hurricane Sandy. And not all financial markets are taking today off. Bond markets are staying open until 2 p.m. Cohen says that the NASDAQ had some time to prepare for today after Carter died in late December. His company made its plans with other exchanges, regulators, and other parts of the financial industry.
It did require a large undertaking, but we thought it was worth the effort, and we had the time. Given when we knew that day would be, we had the time to reflect and make sure that we could manage it appropriately.
The NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange will reopen on Friday morning. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR News.
the next Fresh Air, on the day of Jimmy Carter's funeral, we feature part two of our remembrance of Carter with excerpts of the interviews we recorded over the years. He talked about his poetry, his concerns about how intertwined politics and religion had become, a somber holiday season soon after 9/11, and we have an interview with Carter and his daughter, Amy. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at nervivehealth.com. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Jimmy Carter goes home today after a funeral here in Washington, which we will cover live on NPR. The former president's family takes his remains to a private service in his hometown. Almost 2 years ago, when the former president first went into hospice care, we placed a call to that hometown and reached Kim Carter Fuller.
I'm in Plains, Georgia. I'm looking out the window at downtown Plains.
She is Jimmy Carter's niece, the daughter of his brother Billy. She's lived her whole life in Plains.
Downtown area is one main street, one block, basically. And my office is on that block.
Well, good. That's great. You're at the center of the action then, I suppose.
Yes, I am.
Her uncle Jimmy grew up nearby, went away to the Navy, and returned, built a house, the house that he and First Lady Rosalynn Carter called home right to the end. Carter ran for the state legislature and then won election as governor and then the presidency. Fuller was in college when he won the national election in 1976.
When he won the presidency that night, Plains was swamped. And this was before, you know, good internet and all that kind of stuff. They were broadcasting on the sides of buildings downtown.
This next couple of months, I'll be doing the best I can to prepare myself to be a president, of which all of you will be proud. And I believe that I can make the kind of leadership in the White House that can tap the greatness that's in all of you.
I'm just thinking about the power of that moment. This is someone being elected president and the first president from the South since before the Civil War. That must have been quite a moment to live through.
It was. It was. I'm getting chill bumps just thinking about it. It was the type of moment that I think most of us, and I know me in particular, we kind of thought, well, this might never happen again. Same thing when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, we had a celebration down here, downtown, right outside where I am now, and we were able to celebrate with him.
Do you recall what it was like when you saw him in the first months or years after his defeat?
Yeah, he was very sad. My dad owned a service station here in town, and after my husband and I got married, my husband ran it. And I will never, ever forget the night that Uncle Jimmy was coming home, or the afternoon after he lost. And
he was leaving
the White House. And the phone rang in the station, and Daddy answered it. It was a phone on the wall. And I will always remember him saying, just come home. We're waiting for you. Just come home. And it was pouring down rain here. And the streets were just thronged with people, just like they were the night that he won. People were here to welcome him back home. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, have asked, well, why did they move back to Plains? Why did they do that? Well, that's one reason they did. Because they knew if they had to go somewhere, it was time to come home.
Mm. What do you think kept him going all those years? Traveling the world, getting involved in elections, getting involved in peace negotiations, building houses for Habitat for Humanity, writing book after book after book. Where do you think that energy came from?
I think one thing that motivated him was the fact that he, deep in his heart, I think he knew what people needed. And he just had such a strong sense of, I think, morality, compassion. He's a servant leader. And that servanthood just, he couldn't keep it closed off. He had to share it.
If you were asked to sum him up in a few sentences, what would you say?
Uncle Jimmy is a man who doesn't just talk about how he feels about his place in the world. He walks that talk. I've never known him to have empty words, so to speak. I've always known him to be a person who does what he feels is right. He is a deeply caring man, and he shows that care to not only his family, but to the people around him. I just wish I had 1/10 of what he has inside of him.
Kim Carter Fuller is executive director of Friends of Jimmy Carter and a niece of the late president. We spoke in 2023. We'll have special coverage of Carter's state funeral this morning. You can listen live on the NPR app or on many local stations.
Here is a heads up to Girl Scout cookie fans. 2 cookie flavors will be discontinued after this year. But do not fret, your Thin Mints are safe. NPR's Nita Ulaby has more.
You are forgiven if you've never heard of the 2 cookies that got laid off. One is called Toast Yays. It's based on the cinnamon mapliness of French toast and came out in 2021. The other is Girl Scout S'mores, evoking the classic campfire treat.
What is the cream in there? Is that toothpaste?
The s'mores were roasted last year in Dustin Nickerson's podcast called Don't Make Me Come Back There. The comedian and his sidekicks compared the Girl Scout s'mores cream filling to that stuff between your tiles, caulk.
Yeah, that tastes like an adhesive. That is not good.
The Girl Scout s'mores debuted in 2017. They're among dozens of cookies that have been added and discontinued since Girl Scouts first started selling them to raise money more than 100 years ago. Remember Scott Tees or Savannah Smiles? Wendy Liu is Chief Revenue Officer for Girl Scouts of the USA. She's in charge of the cookie program.
So we do review our lineup on a regular basis. We definitely want to make sure we're maximizing the sales opportunity for our girls.
Around 700,000 Girl Scouts around the country sell about 200 million boxes of cookies each year, Lou says. And how much does that make for the Girl Scouts of the USA?
Roughly about $1 billion in revenue for the organization.
That means at least some Toast Yays and Girl Scout S'mores helped local Girl Scouts to camp, craft, volunteer, and to live by the Girl Scout law. Neta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It has not been a quiet 4 years for Bill Burns as director of the CIA.
I've taken 84 trips overseas during that time, covered more than 1 million miles, and, you know, it's just deepened the pride that I have in the work of this agency.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I sit down with Burns on his way out to ask about Russia, Iran, ISIS, and more. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. On Capitol Hill this morning, A 21-gun salute as the body of former President Jimmy Carter was taken from the U.S. Capitol to begin the short journey to Washington National Cathedral for this morning's state funeral. NPR's Christian Wright says President Biden has declared this to be a national day of mourning.
Biden is calling on the American people to pay homage to the memory of former President Carter today. To observe the National Day of Mourning, federal government offices are closed, and the U.S. Postal Service is suspending regular mail delivery. U.S. stock markets are also pausing today to honor the long life of the nation's 39th president. Flags will continue to fly at half staff through the end of the month.
At least five people have been killed by wildfires burning out of control in Southern California. More than 130,000 people in and around Los Angeles have been forced from their homes. Nicole Mao with the Red Cross says many have gone to shelters after losing everything.
There are dozens of folks who've evacuated their home that are now having the chance to rest their heads. And hopefully for a moment they can get well-deserved rest.
Mao was speaking to MSNBC. This is NPR News from Washington. Texas, Arkansas, and Tennessee are among more than a dozen states expecting snow over the next day or so. Cities including Dallas, Little Rock, Memphis, and Nashville are forecast to have several inches of snow on the ground by tomorrow night. Karen Czar with member station WUKY reports on efforts in Lexington, Kentucky to bring people inside from the cold temperatures.
When temperatures fall, Brother Thomas Caudill hops in a large van with the decal Compassionate Caravan. On Tuesday night, he cased the city looking for anyone with nowhere to go.
There's over probably 70 people out here or more, and go find whoever you find, bring them in.
One by one, Caudill found people walking the streets or huddled near buildings. He offered rides to a hotel paid for by the Catholic Action Center. More than 150 hotel rooms are being rented by the city and private organizations to house Lexington's homeless this week. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in Lexington.
College football's first playoff semifinal match is tonight in Florida. Notre Dame plays Penn State in the Capital One Orange Bowl. The winner advances to the national championship game against the winner of tomorrow night's other semifinal between Texas and Ohio State. That's in the Goodyear Cotton Bowl Classic being played in Arlington, Texas. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. By now, you've probably seen the pictures and heard the stories from the areas in and around Los Angeles that are engulfed in flames fueled by desert winds. At least five people have died. The Palisades Fire is the largest of five wildfires spread through the area. It has already burned through more than 17,000 acres. The state agency CAL FIRE says it is the most destructive blaze in California's history in the month of January. Throughout the morning, we've been checking in with individuals and officials in the area. Councilwoman Tracy Park is with us now. She represents the Pacific Palisades neighborhood where the fire is raging. Hello. How are you doing?
It's been a pretty horrible 48 hours, truthfully.
Tell me what you're seeing. I know you and your team have all been out, you know, in the area, you know, on the ground throughout this. Tell me just some of the things that you have seen.
Well, as the fire broke out on Tuesday, I was out at the command post at Will Rogers State Beach, and it looked like a volcano had erupted. There was just fire raging through the town and down the hillsides. And, of course, the firefighting operations were impacted by 80 and 100-mile-an-hour gusts of wind, which prevented the ability to get assets into the air to fight the fire. There were chaotic evacuations and traffic backlogs. It was an absolutely terrifying situation on the ground. Overnight, the fire continued to grow, and as I was able to return to Palisades yesterday after the sun came up to get a first look at the scope and scale of the devastation, the scenes were absolutely apocalyptic. Mm. Most of the Palisades is gone.
It's devastating. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of time after this to talk about what went wrong and what could have been or done differently. But for right now, the thing that seems most immediate is that some of the fire hydrants that firefighters were tapping into ran dry yesterday. Do you know why that is?
So I had heard anecdotally during the course of the fire that there were issues with the water, but it wasn't until DWP announced it during the press conference yesterday that we learned that the demand on services was four times the normal load, and that impacted the ability of our firefighters to have enough water pressure to actually fight the fire. And unfortunately, you know, fighting a wildfire with a fire engine and a fire hydrant, that's not how you do it. You know, that's normally it would be an air assault on the fire. And because they weren't able to do that, they had no other alternative but to try to put it out by ground with the hydrant. And that is something that, you know, we learned about yesterday. It, I think, raises more questions than answers. And it's, to me, feels indicative of what has been chronic underinvestment in the city of Los Angeles and critical infrastructure, as well as our public safety resources. This particular area is in the very high fire severity zone. Many of these risks and threats are well known to the community. And so there is a lot of concern about this amongst residents who unfortunately have now lost everything.
That is Los Angeles Councilwoman Tracy Park. Councilwoman, thank you so much for joining us. We will all keep a good thought for you and for all the people that you're trying to take care of right now.
Thank you. Stay safe.
A federal appeals court may issue a ruling today that could help bring an end to the 9/11 terrorism case at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This case has dragged on for more than two decades without going to trial. It involves the alleged mastermind of the attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It's part of a legal fight that has pitted Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin against the U.S. military court that he oversees. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has been covering this story for many years now and is back with us to explain all this. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us about this ruling that you're on the lookout for.
This deals with whether Mohammed will be allowed to get a plea deal. He and three co-defendants have agreed to plead guilty in exchange for up to life in prison. They would admit guilt in the deaths of nearly 3,000 people, and there would be no trial and no death penalty. But at the request of the Pentagon this week, the Justice Department asked a federal appeals court for two things. One, block the guilty pleas. To at least delay a hearing that's supposed to happen Friday so the court could have more time to decide whether to block those pleas. And those are the rulings that could come today.
Okay, but back up here. If these men have already agreed to plead guilty, why is there a debate over whether they are allowed to?
This is an ongoing legal saga that started when the plea deals were announced last summer by the military court. The deals were huge news because the 9/11 case is so gridlocked, and this was a way to end the gridlock. But 48 hours later, Secretary Austin took those plea deals off the table.
And why did he do that?
So as remarkable as this sounds, considering that, as you said, he oversees the military commissions, he said he had not known about the plea deals. Since then, two military courts, including an appeals panel, have ruled pretty decisively that Austin is not allowed to rescind the plea deals so the guilty pleas can go forward. The legal debate should have been over at that point, according to a former military commissions lawyer I spoke with named Ian Moss, who's now in private practice. And Moss says by not accepting the plea deals, the government is squandering a chance to end a case that does not seem to have an end in sight otherwise.
This is essentially snatching victory from the jaws of self-defeat. After so long with no to minimal progress, there's finally an opportunity to have a resolution and closure.
And Michelle, Secretary Austin's own prosecutors have said plea deals are the best resolution.
So is there a precedent for DOJ getting involved in Guantanamo cases like this?
When it comes to defense lawyers for Guantanamo detainees, they have often gone to federal court to ask for some kind of relief, although they're usually denied. But Georgetown University law professor Steve Vladek tracks Guantanamo and told me that this scenario, where the prosecution side has already lost twice and is now asking a federal court to order a military judge to block the guilty pleas, is rare.
To call it unusual is a vast understatement. I mean, we've had the military commissions in some way, shape, or form now for over 20 years, and we haven't had a case like this before.
So if there is a ruling today, Sasha, what happens next?
Somebody is going to be unhappy no matter who rules, the losing side. And that losing side will probably take this to the Supreme Court. That's the next legal step after federal appeals. That could drag out the process for many more months, probably even years, because if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is not allowed to plead guilty under a Biden administration, he almost certainly will not be allowed under a Trump administration.
And briefly, Sasha, what about the 9/11 family members?
Oh, they're so frustrated, so tired, so disillusioned, but all they can do for now is wait and watch.
That is NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer. Sasha, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
The state funeral of the late President Jimmy Carter will bring you the latest from Washington's National Cathedral next time in Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. One thing you learn as a reporter is to call people on the phone, which is harder than for past generations. Surveys show young people resist making phone calls. So a UK college wants to help students get over telephobia. Nottingham College students practice doing job interviews by phone or calling restaurants to see if they're open. Now they just have to hope that somebody is willing to pick up the phone on the other end. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President-elect Trump plans changes throughout the federal government. He's staffing his administration with aides who consider it wrong that Congress gave some federal agencies a measure of independence from the president. And that raises questions about what happens to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Congress established the CFPB after the Great Recession to write and enforce rules for the financial industry. In President Trump's first term, the CFPB ensured millions of dollars reached consumers who'd been misled by financial institutions. This very week, the agency under President Biden announced medical debt will not affect credit scores anymore. Christine Chen Zinner is a senior policy counsel at Americans for Financial Reform, a nonpartisan group that advocates for stricter regulation of Wall Street. She spoke with A. Martinez about what else the agency has done.
Last month, the CFPB finalized a rule to lower these incredibly outrageous overdraft fees from around $35 per overdraft fee down to $5 per overage. Earlier, they slashed credit card late fees that were as high as $41 down to $8 per late fee. Unfortunately, while the Biden-appointed regulators have generally been pretty aggressive on behalf of consumers, Wall Street and its allies have really exploited Trump's transformation of the judiciary. Particularly, we've noticed in the Fifth Circuit, which includes courts in Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. And quite a few consumer protection regulations were immediately challenged. There was also an effort to target discriminatory lending. That was also challenged in the Fifth Circuit. And then in December, within hours of the overdraft fee rule to reduce overdraft fees, financial institutions immediately challenged the rule in Mississippi.
Looking back, Christine, on Trump's first term, what specific things did he do to try and ding this organization?
Trump's first term was about driving Wall Street's lobby priorities and agenda, not really about protecting consumers. One of the things that happened was Director Kathy Craninger gutted crucial rules that were set to protect consumers from predatory payday and car title loans. And without these kind of guardrails, borrowers can be trapped into a cycle of never-ending debt. Director Craninger also relaxed financial institution reporting requirements. She also eased mortgage disclosure rules and rules around credit card disclosures. And the CFPB at the time waived rules on prepaid cards that were supposed to speed pandemic relief, but which people were later nickel and dimed with lots of junk fees just to access their payments or check balances.
So a new administration is almost upon us. What might change with this new administration? And also wondering, too, considering how close Elon Musk is to Donald Trump's ear, how that might change things.
Despite lots of attempts to dismantle this agency, the structure of the CFPB can come through a Trump administration intact, as it has before. This means having a single director with a secure funding stream, and this was validated by the Roberts Supreme Court. It would really require big bipartisan votes in the Senate to change that. That said, the overall atmosphere right now isn't great, with Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy hating on the CFPB and tweeting. And there's nothing stopping Trump and the Republican Party from installing a director who just wants to tear the agency down from the inside. However, I will say Trump ran as a populist. At one point, he even proposed capping credit card interest rates. So I think the Trump administration really has a decision to make about whether any of the populist rhetoric that came out of their campaign is meaningful or just a cover to let Wall Street take control of the CFPB.
Christine Chen Zinner is senior policy counsel at Americans for Financial Reform, a nonpartisan coalition focused on financial accountability. Christine, thanks.
Thank you so much, Jay. It was great chatting.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Biden administration says a record 24 million people have enrolled in health plans from Affordable Care Act marketplaces. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports that could change when President-elect Trump takes office.
If you've heard this before, record enrollment in healthcare.gov and the state marketplaces, that's because there was just a record set last year and the year before.
This year, I was actually expecting the enrollment growth to maybe plateau a bit.
That's Cynthia Cox of KFF, a nonpartisan health research organization. She says the past few years, there were clear reasons for those record numbers, like lower premiums and higher demand because of the COVID pandemic. Nothing big changed this year that would keep pumping up demand.
So I think it's really remarkable that it's continuing to reach new record highs.
This year's record, 24 million people, is a lot. When President Biden took office 4 years ago, it was only 12 million. And that increase has chipped away at the overall number of uninsured people in the U.S. Javier Becerra, Secretary of Health and Human Services, briefed reporters earlier this week.
Today, more than 300 million Americans have health coverage. That's a record number.
White House domestic policy advisor Neera Tanden told reporters on the call, these numbers show that Biden administration policies have worked.
We made the largest investment ever into outreach efforts that help people sign up for health insurance. We've also eliminated bureaucratic red tape. And crucially, we've lowered health insurance premiums.
Now the question is, will any of this last after President Trump takes office? Trump has kept open the possibility of repealing the 14-year-old Affordable Care Act. He said in the presidential debate that he had the concepts of a plan for replacing it. Republicans, who are set to take the majority in both houses of Congress, by and large oppose the ACA. They especially don't like the enhanced federal subsidies from the pandemic era. Many people can now get plans for $10 a month. Those subsidies will expire next December unless Congress extends them. Again, here's Cynthia Cox from KFF.
If I was placing a bet, I would feel much more comfortable betting that the enhanced subsidies will be allowed to expire at the end of this year.
Neither the Trump-Vance transition team nor House Speaker Mike Johnson's office responded to NPR's request for comment. Cox says the only way the ACA boom could continue is if a few Republicans join Democrats in voting to extend the subsidies. And that might happen because...
where you have seen the most growth in ACA signups and also where people are benefiting the most financially actually tends to be in red states.
The biggest growth has been in Texas. In the last 4 years, enrollment there has gone up more than 200%. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Much of this country faces cold weather. It is 19 degrees here in Washington this morning, but at least most of us can turn up the heat. People in parts of Moldova have some trouble with that part. The former Soviet Republic is facing a winter heating crisis because they are a casualty of geopolitics. They were affected when a deal that allowed natural gas to move through pipelines from Russia to Europe collapsed. NPR's Charles Maines is covering this from Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Morning.
Who's affected?
Well, you know, this crisis is really focused on a specific region of Moldova called Transnistria. It's a self-declared republic. It's not recognized internationally. That broke away from Moldova in the aftermath of the end of the Soviet Union. And it survived thanks to support from Moscow, not only in the form of Russian peacekeeping troops on the ground, but also cheap Russian gas. Now that that gas has been cut off, Transnistria has seen a cascade of problems. First, there was no heat and hot water, with residents told to gather firewood or head to warming stations. Then nearly all factories ground to a halt. And now it's important to keep in mind that Transnistria's key power plant has managed to switch to operating on coal. That's the good news. The bad is people have also switched to portable electric heaters. And that stressed the power grid to the limits, says the breakaway region's leader, Vadim Krasnoselsky. So here Krasnoselsky explains that Transnistrians are using a third more electricity than the power station can actually produce. And he warns that if that continues, the whole station will blow. There'll be no electricity at all.
Okay, this story teaches us something about infrastructure and about the way the economy works. So how did this gas crisis come about?
Well, the truth is Russia's gas trade with Europe, which goes back decades, unraveled amid the war in Ukraine, with most of Europe boycotting Russian exports in solidarity with Kyiv. There was, however, one notable exception until recently, a Russian pipeline that continued to run through Central Europe through, of all places, Ukraine.
Yeah.
Another reason for this was that Ukraine had continued to honor a pre-invasion contract to export Russian gas to countries like Slovakia, Austria, and Moldova, with Kyiv collecting transit fees. Only that agreement formally ended January 1st, and Ukraine's government refused to extend it, saying it was akin to blood money.
Okay, so Ukraine takes another step in its conflict with Russia. They end the gas transit deal that a number of European countries depend upon. And how have different countries been dealing with it?
Well, you know, Ukraine gave some warning here. So even if not everybody's happy about it, most of Europe has come up with other energy solutions, including Moldova, frankly, which imported energy from the West, albeit at higher prices, which is no small ask for one of Europe's poorest countries. And yet Moldova remains vulnerable because of problems in this breakaway region, Transnistria, which never made the switch away from cheap Russian gas.
Well, what role is Russia playing here?
Well, the Kremlin spokesman this morning blamed Ukraine and Moldova for the crisis. However, Moldova argues there are these wider geopolitics at play. You know, gas exports have long been a tool of Russian influence in Moldova, but particularly at moments when Moldova's government has tried to move out of Russia's orbit. And that's exactly what's happening now as the current government pursues membership in the European Union. The end of this Ukraine transit deal actually coincided with Russia suspending all gas exports to Moldova, supposedly over debts. It's a charge Moldova disputes. In fact, Moldova's Prime Minister, Adrian Rician, argues Russia is weaponizing the moment with an eye towards key elections in Moldova next fall.
The meaning of all of this is for Russia to create instability in the region, but also very importantly to influence the results of the parliamentary elections in Moldova.
Well, whether that's Russia's aim or not, and some observers argue you can't let Moldova's government off the hook entirely. They say if there's a humanitarian crisis in Transnistria, it's a challenge that Moldova needs to meet if it wants to smooth over resentments.
You taught me something about a strategic part of the world. NPR's Charles Maines, thanks so much.
Welcome, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.